The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got Jim in the office, which is a rare feat on a Friday, although he didn't come in just for us on the podcast. He really came in because he has a haircut. So now I know what it takes to get him to drive up on a Friday, schedule him some personal grooming time. So I'm glad you're in the office here. It's less technically involved than connecting remotely to the studio down south.
Well, it's good to be. It's a little odd to be here on a Friday. Usually I work from home, folks, on a Friday, as you all know. But Chris is correct. Needed a haircut today. And at least I have had a cut.
True. I don't have to schedule any time out of work to get my hair done. Yeah. It's every couple of weeks. I just kind of
buzz it
in the shower. And yeah.
That's a good way of doing it. But no, I do have a haircut and I'm meeting a friend for lunch. And of course, we got a lot going on in the office. So I needed to come in and get some stuff done. But that's what I'll be doing today. And it brings me into the office. And supposedly, does it sound different? I don't even listen to the podcast. So I don't know.
It sounds a little bit different. Yeah, the acoustics in the rooms are different.
Okay.
For sure. And then the microphone you were using was different at your house. But I just gave you that one to swap out. So we're going to get that fixed up. Not that there's anything wrong with the other one. It just sounded a little bit different. But there's no way we're going to ever replicate the perfect acoustics that you have in the penthouse recording studio you're in right now.
Yeah. And for those who are new listeners, yeah. Chris is being very sarcastic when he uses the term penthouse. True. I am at the top of the
highest point in the building.
So, yeah. Well, I think your office is about on the same plane as mine.
No, there's a step up into yours.
That's right. I am in the highest spot. I am in the penthouse.
Absolutely the highest spot.
I am definitely in the penthouse. Mm-hmm. One must step to get into the room I am in.
Mm-hmm. You have to duck a little, though, too, because the ceiling's low.
The room I am in, folks, was built in 1905 mm-hmm. when the house was originally built. The room Chris is in was built in 2010 when mm-hmm. yours truly mm-hmm. remodeled and added a second floor. Mm-hmm. I guess technically a second floor. We took the attic, which is what I'm in, and added a additional pot to it and made it into a much bigger room. And I will say, at least, you never saw this when I first bought this building, did you? Did you?
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Oh, you did?
I was with you when you bought it. Mm-hmm.
I think the original wood from 1905 was in this attic.
Mm-hmm.
It was scary coming up in here. I thought the Chucky doll was going to run out at me.
It's almost as scary as the basement crawl space area.
Oh, that's worse.
I never go down there.
Yeah, there's evil things down there that I want nothing to do with. Yeah, our basement is a little on the creepy side. But anyways, I am in the attic. Chris affectionately calls it the penthouse. I have no windows. I've got a light bulb.
Mm-hmm. It's the shape of the ceiling and no windows that makes it sound so good.
So anyways, that's where I am on this rickety old card table that apparently mm-hmm. one of our old employees gave to us. It's mm-hmm. got to be Chris from 1970. Or earlier, as we said before.
That was the golden age of
card tables. Yeah, this mm-hmm. rickety thing. In fact, it's so rickety, folks. Chris had to take the microphone off it and mount it to a wooden file cabinet that we don't use anymore because we're a digital office. So people are going to think, wow, these guys are so cheap they can't buy a new table for Jim.
Well, this was, that was supposed to be a temporary situation. It's kind of just evolved into a permanent deal. So, one last thing before we get into the question. Do we want to announce the special guest we have coming up? Do we want to start giving people a heads up or surprise
them? When is he coming in?
On the 5th.
Next week?
Well, not a week from this coming week, so about 10 days from now.
Oh, so 10 days from now. I don't care if you...
And the podcast will air on the 6th. It'll be the EDU show that comes out on the 6th that he'll be on. So we're going to, we were able to snag Wade Pfau. He's going to be with us on the show, on the EDU show. And those of you who are familiar with Dr. Pfau know that he's got a new book out. A lot of people are kind of describing it as the ultimate guide to retirement. It's a thick book. I've been going through it. It's like 475 pages, and there's not a lot of pictures. There's a lot of words in there. But there's a, you know, for someone who's trying to grasp this whole thing that we call retirement, there's a lot to consume in there. So I would be hard-pressed to point to another book that was so comprehensive on the topic of retirement. So we're going to talk to him.
Excellent.
So, pretty exciting.
I'm going to woo him with my mastery of the English language. Has he ever listened to our podcast?
I can't imagine, but we'll see. Maybe since he's coming on, maybe he's getting caught up, and he's thinking, what did he agree to?
Who is that guy? Why do I want to go talk to
these
him?
These clowns. So we'll see. Well, he was referred to us by somebody else who's been on the show. So,
correct. Yeah.
So Kevin Lyles from the Rock Retirement Club, who's been on the show before. Is who connected us. So thanks.
Shout out to Kevin. Good to get Wade on. I mean, I've seen him many, many times speak at industry events. I picked a book up from him once. I'm going to see if he remembers me. I'm the guy who got one of your reverse mortgage books at the Retirement Income Summit.
Do
you remember me? I said hi.
Anyway, so look forward to that, everybody. That should be a good show.
All right, let's jump into this because yours truly has a haircut to attend to.
Perfect.
We're going to lead with a Social Security question, folks, like we always do. This is more of a Social Security comment, not really a question, but I think Chris can expand on some of what this individual was talking about. This came in actually in mid-August, so it gives you an idea of how far behind I am on some of these emails. But I still think, Chris, you can opine a little bit on this and answer this guy's comment and explain to people what he's talking about. But it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I've heard two podcasts recently where I was waiting to hear you," and by you, it's got to be you, Chris, not me, because this was Social Security related, "hear you mention the child in care Social Security benefit, but you didn't. I'm referring to Q&A 2131, where a doctor had a minor child, and another one where a retired couple had a disabled child. On the first, the doctor's wife, presumably the mother of the child, would be eligible for a child in care benefit equal to 50% of the doctor's primary insurance amount until the minor child turned 18, regardless of the spouse's age. This will be in addition to the minor child's 50% benefit. On the second, the retired couple was expecting to wait until 70 to claim Social Security. But if one of them claimed now, decreased benefit, so whoever would have the smaller benefit at 70 should claim. The other spouse would be eligible for the child in care, which again would be 50% of the claimant's primary insurance amount, and the disabled child would also get 50%, which would likely be higher than his own benefit, his own meaning the disabled child's, I assume. Of course, none of this helps their conversion quandary on whether or not they should convert to a Roth, but it is still an option you should have thrown in the mix. Child in care seems to be a little known, but potentially a very valuable tool for parents with disabled children, as I am. So I would appreciate you mention it to help others in the same boat."
A couple things. First, I'll agree that if there was no mention of that in those two cases, and this was long enough ago, I don't remember exactly what was discussed, but I'll trust that they were listening. They're clearly in tune with this topic. And I probably should have mentioned that in the overall scheme of things for those two for something to consider. But there's a few the comments in this particular email that aren't quite right. So let me clarify that, because the child and care benefit isn't quite as good as what's being described here. So let me first describe what it is. Essentially, think of it as a spousal benefit that's available to spouses when they otherwise might not be able to collect a spousal benefit, usually due to an age issue, but they're granted a special spousal benefit when they are caring for the child of a number holder is the affectionate term Social Security uses, a number holder who has claimed their Social Security benefit. So to kind of put that in more plain language, if someone claims their benefit and has a child under the age of 16, this is where one of the factual mistakes that was mentioned in this particular email, child and care benefits are triggered when you're under 16 years old. The idea is there's an extra benefit paid when your spouse is caring for your child who is young enough that needs care, and maybe the spouse can't work as much as they could have because they are caring for this child. So they throw an extra benefit at the family, if you will. But at age 16, the system assumes that they don't need as much care. They could come home from school on their own. So it's not preventing the spouse from going out and earning. If that's the case. So that's why there's this different rule. Child benefits themselves are available until age 18 or 19 if they're still in high school or if they're disabled. So they kind of mixed up the ages there. The child and care for the spouse, that's that special spousal benefit that's available when there's a child in the family. And remember, someone has to have claimed Social Security retirement benefit, so that's going to be age 62 or above. So this doesn't happen to a lot of people unless they have, and I totally agree with the last point that they made, a disabled child. It's rare to have a 62, 65, 66-year-old who's claimed to have a child under the age of 16. It does happen, but it is not particularly common. But lots of folks out there are in a position where they have a disabled child that they're caring for who's well over the age of 16, and still there's benefits available for a spouse at any age when they're caring for that disabled child. Once the one, usually the main breadwinner in the family, has filed for their benefits, you know, there's age issues here when things happen. The specific cases they mentioned from those other two emails I don't have in front of me, so I'm not going to remind people of that. But I did want to point out that there's that issue. So the age issue was a little bit off in the description here. The second thing I'll point out is that it sounded pretty attractive the way they were describing it. You know, the child gets 50%. Well, let's start back up. Someone had to have filed, so they're receiving 100% of their retirement benefit, unless they claimed early, might be reduced, but they're receiving a full benefit oftentimes. Then their child, who's either disabled or is under the age of 18 or 19 if they're still in high school, is collecting 50% of their PIA. And if they're under 16 or the child's disabled, the spouse can get that child and care benefit, which is 50%. But you're going to bump up against the family maximum. So don't ever forget the family maximum. The family maximum says that on any one number holder's record, there's a maximum amount that can be paid out. And essentially that number is between 150 and 180%. There's a complex formula I won't go into here, but they limit you. So if it's not, you can't collect an unlimited number of 50% benefits as auxiliary. So at no time would you collect all of yours and then 50% for your spouse, for the child in care, and 50% for the child. That would be collecting, you know, 200%. You're going to bump up against that family maximum. So the total benefit is a little bit less, and potentially a lot less if you're one of those with a formula where your family maximum is 150%. It is possible that the child in care really doesn't add much versus what the child is. all this means, all this complexity that I just walked through, means that when you're looking at a claiming decision, if you have a minor child or a disabled child in the family, this needs to be considered and looked at overall when you're making your final claiming decision, because these extra, what we call auxiliary benefits, which is what spousal and child benefits are referred to, auxiliary benefits, sometimes turning yours on, it's not just about your own. It's about turning yours on and opening the door to other auxiliary benefits, which can swing the pendulum of attractiveness for a claiming date towards claiming earlier versus later. So it's well worth looking into before you make that final claiming decision. There's a lot of confusion about Social Security. Child and care benefits is probably one of the least well-known factors. But when you are getting anywhere near claiming age, you should start to be investigating what exactly is available to you and your family and given your specific circumstances, so you don't miss out on dollars that you could have otherwise claimed. The thing with Social Security is you kind of get one shot at claiming, and it's very difficult to redo it or fix something if you realize you should have done it differently. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to go back in time if you missed an opportunity. So once you get, close to 60 years old, I'd say you need to start getting your ducks in a row to figure out what exactly is going on with your Social Security benefits for your family in total, and make sure that you are approaching this in the most optimal way.
Perfect. I like it.
Thanks.
Okay, we've got a few other Social Security questions, but we got a ton of non-Social Security questions that we will get to. Mm-hmm. So let's jump into some of those, and I don't know if I should start with a comment first from a listener or a question. Let's jump into the comment, because I truly feel this listener had to be listening to another podcast, not ours, but you'll see what I mean when I say that, because I don't think we have ever done what he's accusing us of saying or doing. And I'm not sure if he directed this at me, because I say it a lot, but so do you. So he begins, "I love the show, except when you continually harp on those of us who are older financial advisors as being mentally diminished. It feels mean-spirited, and I wonder if I'll be hearing that from you when you're that age. I know you're talking about clients and their ability to manage their finances and position it with the usual disclaimers about being one study, and it doesn't mean everyone that age will be diminished," and then he says, "like Warren Buffett, but still it drives the point to your audience. They hear one thing and feel like you might be trying to eliminate a certain segment of your competition with the big microphone you have. It's ageism. It's a stereotype. And I know you're above that. But I do love the show otherwise. So here is an older advisor. I have never, and Chris, you have never, ever said not to work with an older advisor.
I don't remember ever saying that. We do certainly talk about the challenges of diminished capacity as you age in general. And, we talk about different reports along those lines, but we're trying to make the point of make sure you're not setting yourself up with too complicated of a plan as you age, so that you're susceptible to mistakes or being taken advantage of, et cetera. It's really just kind of preparing yourself. And I look at myself the same way. I don't think I'm going to be immune to aging. I'm already feeling the effects of aging. I'm not as sharp as I was when I was 40. Honestly, now I have the excuse that a lot of brain power was drained by kids. and Jim,
what's my excuse?
I'm not sure, but I can totally see it. I mean, it's certainly I have a lot of abilities still, but I totally will be setting myself up with as simple of a approach to reach my own personal retirement as possible, not adding any complexities unless I have to. That's really what we're talking about. I don't recall ever.
I've never said don't work with an advisor. They're older, and I'm not sure if that's what he thinks he heard. We do say all the time, folks, and listener who's obviously an advisor. I know we have a lot of advisors who listen to this show, and that's great. We have never specifically called out older advisors, but we do warn our clients all the time that, yes, there is a very definitive study from Harvard, another one from Texas Tech. There's this other thing called Common Sense and Life. Just look at elderly people you know. Chris and I work with a lot of elderly people in their 80s and 90s. The regulators acknowledge this and force us to do specialized training every year on how to spot diminished capacity in seniors. They pass laws specifically mandating certain people report this to the authorities. They've given immunity to financial advisors to report if they feel financial fraud may be happening to a senior. Why do they pass all these rules? Because many of us, not all of us, clearly not this listener, I'm going to guess he's an older advisor, and hell, Chris and I aren't that far from 60. He may be an older advisor, and he feels that we're certainly not sharing this in an effort to diminish our competition. Chris and I are far too busy to even care about our competition. And we don't share this with our listener, in an effort to get them to work with younger advisors. We do it in an effort to get them. What do I say all the time, listeners? Do not look at your retirement through the eyes of someone in their 40s, 50s, even 60s. Look at it through the eyes of someone who will be in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's the whole reason I'm spending time out in Kentucky and Ohio and thinking of moving there. It's not because the 50-something-year-old Jim wants to live out there now. It's because the 70, 80, 90-year-old Jim is not going to like living in Colorado anymore. And I owe it to myself. I owe it to myself to go out there and see if I like it and would move there. Mm-hmm. And you need to do that with your own life, not go to Kentucky and see if you want to live there. But look at your retirement through the eyes that you may be older. And if you're delusional if you don't think diminished capacity could happen to you, that you are going to stay as sharp as anything.
Well, and you might. There's rare people who have no diminished capacity.
And he points out Warren
Buffett.
Now, mm-hmm. I don't know Warren personally.
Nor do I.
So I don't know if he's as sharp now as he was in his 30s, but my gut says no. Look at our own president, for Pete's sakes. You think he's as sharp right now? He's not the brightest bulb in the closet. The sharpest bulb in the... See, look at me. I can't... Well, what am
That's
I trying to say?
That's
what am
ironic
I,
right
What am
there.
I trying to say? Sharpest bulb in the... No, the...
Sharpest knife in the drawer.
Brightest bulb on the tree. Got it.
Or that one. That's one I haven't heard, but that we can go with that. That makes sense.
Brightest bulb on the tree? Well, it's a new one. Yeah, I made a new one. Yeah. Look at me, listener. I could have nailed that in my 30s.
Well, maybe.
I think I could have.
Okay.
The thing is, all jokes aside, I think our president was far sharper in his 30s and 40s and 50s than he is now in his 70s, and Lord only knows what he's going to be in his 80s. And we're not making fun of him, so please save the nasty emails from political people. I'm just saying this is reality and can happen to us. We are not picking on you for being an older advisor. And I don't think people will not hire someone just because they're an older advisor. They're going to value your life experience and your knowledge. They're going to value that immensely. But I think anyone, whether they are interviewing an older advisor in his 60s and 70s or a younger advisor in their 30s and 40s, if that advisor is sitting there and forgetting some things as they're talking doesn't even know what the client is asking them about, they're not going to hire them, whether they're 60 or 30. You're just not going to do it. If I take my car to a mechanic and an older mechanic comes out and knows instantly what the problem is and the younger mechanic is going, yo, dude, let me go look this up, who do you think I'm going to hire? But if it's the other way around, it's the same thing. So it's not ageism in that respect. I think being an older advisor is far more valuable. I've been questioned by clients before when they've had to work with younger advisors in our office questioning me, do they know what you know? And I tell them I would never have them meeting with you if they couldn't handle what it is I'm asking them to do. Do they know as much as me? Not even close. But do they know how to handle the task of yours that I assigned to them? Absolutely. I was just asked that not too long ago because we've got two young junior advisors. And it doesn't offend me when they ask. That technically, Chris, is ageism as well. But do keep that in mind, listener. But listeners as a whole, Chris and I are always going to be pointing that out to you. And it's why we came up with doing retirement the way we do. The younger you owes it to the older you to keep things simple. Guaranteed, safe, simple, straightforward. Retirement is complex enough. You don't need to make your investments complex. Keep them simple. It's why we favor lifetime secure income to cover minimum dignity floor, yada, yada, yada. But we always share, Chris, not only how we do things, but what else do we share?
The why. And so when we're talking about, you know, preparing for diminished capacity, that goes into the why category of why we decided it's preferable to set things up as simple as possible without being overly simplistic where you're sacrificing too much. There's a good balance there, but there's a lot of approaches that they completely disregard this, in my opinion, setting up an extraordinarily complicated situation that might be maybe not even fully understandable at 60. I've seen some that are so complicated, I'm not sure anybody other than the person who designed it would understand it, and maybe not even them. But definitely things that are way too complicated for a questionable amount of benefit. That's just setting things up for disaster, in my personal opinion. So I prefer the simpler approach, the better.
Okay, but listen, I'm sorry you took it personally as if we're going after older advisors. We are certainly not. And Chris and I are not spring chickens. But I also don't feel I'll be doing what I'm doing in another 20 years. I don't. Number one, I want to retire someday. But number two, I don't think in 20 years I'll be as sharp as I am now. And I don't know if I'm less sharp now as I was 20 years ago. The Harvard study said we reach our peak of financial understanding at 53. But I will say physically, I am not the same man I was 20 years ago. I'm just not. And I do feel our memory does begin to slow and our ability to I heard once, and I'm certainly not a doctor, and if there's any neurosurgeons listening, give us some pointers here. But I heard, Chris, the human brain can't do, technically speaking, can't do more than one thing at a time. But it does them so fast, we sometimes feel, we'll say, oh God, I'm juggling 10 things at once. But your brain handles each thing one at a time. But so fast, it feels like we're doing them all at once. But as you age, it's that ability that is also lost. And that's why older people, as we age, we say, oh God, it takes them forever to say something or to do something that they used to be able to do real quickly. It's because our thinking capacity slows. If you don't think that's going to happen, and it just happens to our bodies, I think you're misleading yourself. But we are certainly not picking on older advisors. To this day, Ed Slott is older than me by a lot. Well, I don't want to say a lot. He might be listening. But he is older than me. And I listen to this man all the time. All the time. I may not agree with everything he says, but I listen and learn from him constantly. And he is in his 60s. I'm not sure if he hit his 70s yet, but he is older than us. And we still listen to him, Chris. So it's not just age-driven, and we're really talking more 70s, 80s, and 90s, and telling people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, as you plan your retirement, look at it through the eyes of someone who's going to be in their 70s and 80s someday, not someone who might be 55 and healthy, or even 60 or 65 and relatively healthy and smart. You will be in your 80s and 90s someday. Okay, we beat that horse to death. I'll move on. Okay, anything else you want to add on that, though?
No.
Perfect.
That's good.
Okay, this next one I'm going to put in the category of why. What are you trying to do? And then we'll just chat briefly about it.
Okay.
So it's also from August. You can see I hit the August pile.
That's good. At least it's from this year.
It is. August 18th, and the next one is from August 17th, and the one you just answered was August 15th. Now, the advisor one was recent. That was in September. But when I got it in, I pulled it off to the side. I didn't want to keep him waiting. Okay, so it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. As far as the $15,000 a year gifting, is there a way I could give each child a $15,000 portion of ownership of our home each year, so that most of the value of my house will have already been given to them by time I die, thereby getting the house out of my total estate and avoiding any possible estate tax on the value of my home?" And as she signed her real name, we're going to call her George, and she is from the fine state of Texas. My question, listener, is, what are you trying to do? Because that's not going to be the easiest way of doing it. Could you do what you described? Yes.
Technically, yeah.
You could. One would do it because it would be a nightmare on ownership structure. Mm-hmm. How are you even going to insure the house? Who's the owner? Who's making the decisions? What happens if one of the children is being sued? And now someone gets an into the entire house because one child owns 18% of it by then. Mm-hmm. That would be a nightmare, listener. But let's back this out, Chris, and ask, what is she trying to do? You alone, Georgette, have an $11.7 million gift and estate tax exemption. Texas does not have a estate tax. To the best of my knowledge, they don't. Does Texas have a state estate tax? Google that real quickly. I don't believe they do. So Chris will proof this in a second. But to the best of my knowledge, Texas does not have an estate tax. The federal government does, but right now you have an $11.7 million exemption. If you are married, you have a almost $23 million combined exemption. If your estate is over that, there's bigger fish to fry than just the value of your home. Now, they are going to be lowering that $11.7 million back to $5 million, where it was supposed to return to January 1st of 2026. The current administration and the current party in charge of Congress, the Democrats, I hate to say that because then I get nasty emails, but they want to lower that, and they proposed it, and chances are that will pass by the end of this year, to lower it to $5 million January 1st of next year, but adjust it for inflation since the passage of the tax cut that changed it, so it's actually going to be $6 million. So it's going to be about $6 million per person, $12 million for a married couple. Could they lower it again in the future? Absolutely. Could they lower it to $1 million where Bernie Sanders wants it? Absolutely. But it's just not in the cards right now. So what I'm trying to describe to you is there's still a lot of federal estate tax exemption. And did you find out if Texas has one?
Texas does not appear to have an estate nor inheritance tax.
Okay.
So we're just talking federal here.
So we're talking federal. I don't know because you don't share anything. She doesn't tell me, Chris, you know, we have $30 million. Can we do this? My gut tells me she doesn't have over $22 million where she's worried about federal estate tax right now. She might be worried about it being cut. And the only reason I say that, listener, is if you did have a net worth greater than $22 million, you have probably already addressed this with a very competent estate planning attorney. So I don't assume you're in that category. She might be worried about it being cut. There's something you can do, and I'm not saying you should do, but if you really wanted to talk about it, you can create, and my name just is Grit, Grat, Grutz. I forget which one I am referencing, but there's a type of grant or trust that you could put your house in now, utilizing some of your $11.7 million exemption amount to put it in all at once. She seems to be trying to do this without losing any of her exemption, Chris, by gifting just $15,000 a year ownership portion to her children. You don't need to do it that way. You got $11.7 million right now. You could put unless you have a $12 million home, but again, if you did, I think you might be having an attorney right now helping you with this. But you don't have to do a little at a time. You can use some of your exemption and put it into I can't think. See, here I am. We just did one of diminished capacity. What is the trust that you put the house into? It's a grantor-style trust. It's
a, I don't know. I can't remember if you do it in a unit trust.
No, it's...
which is a grunt.
The acronym. But. I can't remember the acronym, and I apologize. See? maybe I am losing my memory a little. But there is a trust.
This is so rare, and especially since the... You know, the estate tax exemption has been so large, this kind of went to the back of everyone's mind.
Qualified Personal Residence Trust. God, I knew I would get it.
Yep.
All right. But it's built on a grantor trust foundation. And in short, listener, you put your house in it, and the trust owns it. You no longer do. But you are given the right to live there. Now, you have to live a certain amount of time. My memory for the term of the QPERT, if you will, and I'm going totally by memory, listen, I haven't reviewed this in a long time, but you have to live a certain period of time, and I think the period of time is set by the term of the QPERT. If you die before that limit, the house will be included in your estate, but at the end of the limit, you no longer own the house, and that creates a whole host of problems. Mm-hmm. If your children want to get you out of the house. So usually it comes with a guarantee that they're going to allow you to stay in it. All appreciation while it's in the QPERT will be exempt from your estate taxes because you gave up control of it when you opened it. You completed a completed gift, but you're allowed to live in it. I'm giving you the 60,000 foot view of how these work. The only reason I'm sharing it with you, listener, is if you really are adamant you want to get the value of the house out of your estate, don't try doing it the way you asked me. Go see an attorney, and you've got 3 months to get this done. Why? Part of what the Democrats want to pass is a overhaul of grantor trusts. We mentioned this briefly on the Q&A last week. It's going to impact ILITs. It's going to impact QPERTs. It's going to impact a lot of how they used to use grantor trusts. But they said they will grandfather existing grantor trusts. So you may want to, if you really needed to, go see an estate planning attorney, a good one, not someone who, if their website says they do estate planning, divorce planning, family planning, if they're a jack of all trades, you might want to ignore them. You want someone who just does estate planning and seems competent. Go there and learn about these trusts and see if you want to do one while you still have time. I don't know enough about them to get deep into them, but I do know they exist. And I'm pretty sure it's QPERT, Qualified Personal Residence Trust. And go learn about it while you still have time.
Yeah, and make absolutely sure that before, you know, lunging forward on a strategy, that it is the best strategy for what you're trying to accomplish.
I don't think
someone's
going to
need. I would find it unlikely based on the context of the question that this is the best approach, but we don't know the whole situation, so it might be a lot more, you know, a lot more size to the estate and a lot more issues. We have to remember too that Texas is a community property state, so there's, you know, step up issues at the first death that are advantageous, which you would give up if you're, you know, gifting this away while you're still alive. I don't know what the marital status is.
She doesn't say.
There's those issues. We don't know if there's a lot of unrealized gain in the house that's even worth worrying about there. There's a lot of moving parts here that someone's going to need to determine what you're worried about and then decide, you know, what's the best path to address those particular concerns. Technically, you could do something in the form of what she was describing, but
I mean, that's how, for those who have a self-directed IRA and put, say, a property in it that they're going to rent, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on that, and they don't have, Chris, any other IRA, and they have to start taking their RMDs, they have to get it out exactly as she's describing. They have to distribute out ownership shares in or stake mm-hmm. in that house or building.
Right, as the RMD.
Mm-hmm. As the RMD, exactly. So it can be done. It's just mm-hmm. nothing. I don't want you, I don't see any reason to do it that way. I still don't know why you want to get your house out of your estate, but if it, we don't know enough, but if you truly feel this is what you got to do, you might want to look at one of those qualified personal residence trusts while you still can. They are built on the grantor trust chassis, which is going to go the way of the dinosaur. As Chris and I said, I guarantee you within 3-5 years or less, very, very smart people, far smarter than Chris and I, will have a new type of trust, Chris, not covered by that particular law. I think they can do it. The trust just don't come out of nowhere. They have to look at the tax code, Chris, find the little quirkiness in the wording of things and say, well, because of the way that's worded, I think we can do this. And there'll be people looking for that. But for right now, grantor trusts are probably going to go away. You still got time. If you
they'll be there. They'll just be treated in a way that differently, makes them less attractive.
The grantor trust, Chris, is 100% correct, will still be there, but the value of them will be in the grantor's estate. They are closing or changing the language in the law that created grantor trusts in the first place. They're tightening that language. So you can still have a grantor trust, but it's not going to accomplish what it was meant to. That is to get highly appreciating assets out of an estate without technically, remember I always said you're supposed to be a completed gift? Using a grantor trust, it could still be taxed. Well, I don't want to get too deep in that. We're going to cover it on the next EDU show. But they're closing the loop. I don't want to use the word loopholes. They're changing the way they wrote the original laws and tightening up the tax code, I guess is the way of putting it. That will essentially, Chris, mean you can still have a grantor trust, but the language in the IRC, the tax code IRC, the tax code that was allowing you to do this and keep it out of your estate, we're tightening that language up, and it's actually going to be in your estate. The whole idea of grantor trust, Chris, was to get it out of your estate and all the growth before you died out of your estate. And people have been using these for decades. They're closing that. So you got a little more time, listener, if you want to get your home out of your estate. And anyone else in states with estate tax, because it's much, much lower than the federal tax, or people who think they might be on the limits of federal tax, if you have, especially a second home or something, the QPERTs are qualified personal residence trust, so more on your home, but there are other trusts you can use for your other real estate holdings. You might want to go see an estate planning attorney. All right.
That's the best. If you think that you're in a situation where these are big issues to you, you definitely should be talking to an estate planning attorney.
Yeah, don't listen to two yahoos from Colorado who, we're not estate planning attorneys. We know just enough to tell us, hey, we got to get an attorney and let's start asking them about this, that, and the other thing. But we are not estate planning attorneys. And again, I pulled stuff out of the back of my memory, Chris, because I haven't even used or thought about using a QPERT.
You haven't thought about a QPERT in years.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so I think we covered that one. Let's move on. All righty. This one is from August also, August 17th. It says, hi, Jim, Chris, and Greg. I am, quote unquote, George from Texas. Another Texan. Mm-hmm. Big state it must be.
It is big.
I am George from Texas. Hearing about what happened to Jim, I am currently thinking about buying long-term care. I think he means my stroke. I am currently thinking about buying long-term care insurance for myself. Before making a decision, I have been listening to several other podcasts. Well, there's his first mistake.
Stop.
I'm just kidding, folks. Listen as many as you want. I've been listening to several other podcasts to understand more about the topic. And I noticed those podcasts offer, quote-unquote, advice, which I think is not as trustworthy as yours. Well, let me pause. I think Chris and I both appreciate that. Thank you, listener.
That was a very nice comment.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. I truly do. From those podcasts, I now have a couple of questions. One, all these podcasts seem to favor asset-based policy instead of a traditional pay-as-you-go policy. Their argument is, with an asset-based policy, you will get your money back if you don't need long-term care insurance. However, I wonder if it's truly because the agent will get his or her commission all at once rather than a monthly basis. So let me give you a little, I'm going to pause there. Let me give you a little inside scoop, listener and listeners, into the insurance industry and how most likely the commission structure is going to work on those policies. There are no commission-free long-term care policies right now. There's a couple of commission-free long-term care annuity policies built on the chassis of these hybrids that the listener is questioning about. They're not, we've looked at them. They don't woo me to the point of us saying, wow, we definitely want to run with them. But that's it. There's very few commission-free long-term care insurance right now. So if you buy it, the agent will earn a commission. This listener is right. But here's where he's wrong. Irrespective of if you buy the lump sum policy or a monthly policy, the agent will be paid all at once. That's just the way it works. If you bought an annual policy and the agent is paid all at once and you canceled it, the agent will be exposed to what is called in the industry a chargeback. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean, Chris?
They take back the commission. There's a certain period of time where the policy has to stay in force. Once it goes past that limit, then the agent's commission is protected. But if you cancel prior to that, the agent is at risk of losing the commission.
So I don't think they're recommending it to you for the commission's sake. I'm just sharing that with you. We offer long-term care insurance to our clients as well. We certainly don't push one over the other. There's a lot more deeper than just the return of premium feature on these hybrid policies that one needs to look at. So I don't feel you're on track with your first question. They're not recommending, and I don't know what podcast you're listening to, they're not recommending the hybrids merely out of commission structure because they will be paid a similar amount irrespective of whether they got it all at once or not.
I think where they're running into, that's not what's being focused, is the people talking about it in this way that are really pushing the hybrid. He calls it an asset-based, which is you pay a fixed amount in and then that's it, instead of lifetime premiums. It's addressing the number one concern that has always been talked about by people considering buying. So the potential policyholders, their number one concern is, well, what if I don't use it? What if I end up not needing it? Kind of like, you know, what if my house doesn't burn down? I'll feel really bad. I paid those insurance premiums all the time. People don't usually think about it on their homeowner's insurance, but they think of it that way with long-term care because not everyone's going to need it. There will be people, and that's how insurance works, right? If everybody needed it, it wouldn't make sense to buy insurance. You just have to self-fund. But the fact that not everyone needs it, all policyholders pay in, and then only a certain number actually extract money out. And so you share the risk with other people, essentially, the whole concept of insurance. But the number one thing always people complained about when they were being presented with long-term care insurance is, gee, I don't, you know, look at it. That's a lot of money. Premiums sometimes are kind of high. If I don't need it, my kids don't get any of that money that went in. So they came up with, you know, insurance companies reacted to this concern, this pushback. All the agents were saying, gee, I wish we had something because to overcome this issue that people keep bringing up. And so hybrid policies built on these life insurance chassis came about that essentially then promise you to get back the money you put in, at least, if not more. You know, sometimes it's a little less, but you have protection against just walking away from all the premiums. Well, you wouldn't walk away because you're dead now, but you know, your family not getting any of the premiums that you paid in if you ended up not using it. So I think they're so focused on that. That's what's causing them, but they aren't fully disclosing nothing's free. There's no free lunch. For you to get that benefit, you're giving something else up. Right, Jim. What do they give up generally when they get the feature, if you will, of getting their premium back?
Well, I'm not sure where you're going. There's a couple of things you would give up. A
couple main things.
To me, you get less leverage. You get less LTC
less potential
coverage
benefits. Yeah.
Than you would in a traditional policy. Mm-hmm. All for the possibility, if you never need it, you will get your premium back.
Right.
Again. Was that what you were going for, Chris?
Yeah, generally you get a little more bang for your buck as far as benefits go. If you're willing to walk away from premiums, meaning you pass away and you're okay with the fact that maybe you never got back in benefits as much as you paid in premiums, if you're willing to take that stance, the balance between what you pay in and what you get in benefits is more attractive than a policy where they're promising to at least give you or your beneficiaries back the premiums that you paid in. If you want that benefit, you're going to have to give up something. The insurance company doesn't give you things for free. It's always a trade-off. Always keep that in mind. Anything on an insurance policy that looks better than something else, there's some sort of trade-off going in there generally. There's a slight occasions, I will admit, that during pricing, and this is getting behind the curtain a little bit with insurance pricing, insurance companies will go through phases where they're actively trying to gain market share or not. And so they'll change their pricing a little bit for that reason, which isn't directly in this, you know, trade-off cost-benefit thing I'm talking about. But generally, if a policy is offering you something that another policy isn't, there's 99% of the time something else you're giving up.
So what I would like to do is one more thing, because I don't think I mentioned it. Even if your agent were to sell a hybrid policy, which you're calling a asset-backed policy or however he worded it, and they're paid the commission up front, as you rightly assumed, if that policy gets canceled, they too have a chargeback. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure everybody knows both policies will do a chargeback. But let's get to the deeper thing, listener. I would avoid any person you're working with to get advice on long-term care or any type of financial planning related issue if they only have one solution. If their only answer is to buy an insurance policy and it has to be a hybrid. When we do an insurance analysis, and I'm just sharing what we do, I don't know how other agents do it, but when we do it, we look at a lot more than that. We try to ask the client and go over with the client all the different features of policies, which ones appeal to you, which ones don't. Are you looking for a cash indemnity payout, or are you looking for reimbursement? Are you looking for an insurance company that's going to help with the claims paying process and appoint someone to work with you, and you may not be able to even fill in paperwork when you need it? There's policies that have concierge services that will actually bring someone into your home, often a nurse, that will help you or your family put a care plan together and apply for the coverage, which is very, very important. It's for some people, they want that. For some people, that's not too important because they got a very involved family or something like that. Mm-hmm. Also, what I'm sharing with you, listener, is don't be too quick to rule out a traditional policy, and don't be too quick to rule out a hybrid. You need to look at them both and the features and how mm-hmm. they work. When you compare life insurance policies, especially a term insurance policy, that's a commodity. That's like buying a gallon mm-hmm. of gas. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. It's a term policy. They're all going to work the same. Then you get into a permanent policy, it starts getting complex. But in LTC, they're all different.
Yeah, even more complex.
Because yeah. there's so many options you can add to these policies. There is no way to look at a policy from company A and a policy from company B and a policy from company C and think, okay, they're all the same. Which one do I like? Or which one's cheaper?
Right.
They all have advantages and disadvantages. You need to work with an agent who's going to look at them all. And the final thing I want to say is you do get more leverage with a traditional policy. One strategy we share with people, we've talked about on the podcast, and I would encourage you to even consider you do-it-yourself or Vanguardians. Rather than plow, say, $200,000 into a lump sum policy where you're done with it, you put $200,000 off to the side in a very well-managed, easy investment. We use a particular fund in our office from Vanguard. I don't like to name the individual investments we do, but an allocation fund from Vanguard that is a well-managed, well-performing, 50-year-old, moderately conservative allocation fund. Y'all Vanguardians are already shouting out the name of that fund. But we use a fund like that to put the premium reserve in, and we start debiting the premium every year from that. And oftentimes when we backdate it to see how that strategy would work, the reserve amount, Chris, has supported the premiums. In many instances, not all, depends on the time periods we run. We ran these every 30 days, every month rather, for I think Travis did a 20 or a 30 year period, because that fund's been around for 50 years. And there were some periods, Chris, that yeah, the account balance actually dropped from what you put in, but most, it was actually still growing. and supporting the premiums. Now, we're not saying this works perfect and that everyone should do it, but it is something to think about. You kind of put the premium money off to the side. Now, the advantage to that strategy, even if it stayed level, Chris, or even dropped a little, the advantage is this. If you file a claim on a hybrid policy, what money do you receive first, Chris?
You receive your own money back.
Yeah, the return of the premium. That's the death benefit. You drain your death benefit first. Now, there are a few carriers that maintain a minimum amount of death benefit. There's one in particular, it's $6,000. Even if you got all your premium money back, if you died, $6,000 would still be paid. I joke, it's kind of like a burial plan at that point. I don't know if that's what they did it for, but $6,000, I think, could come a long way to paying a lot of a funeral. I don't know if it'll cover it all. But when you file a claim under a traditional policy in this other funding structure that I described, and I'm not saying everyone should run out and do this at all. I'm saying you might want to consider it. But under that, most traditional policies, when you go under claim, what do they do with the premiums, Chris?
Well, you no longer have to pay the premium, yeah. So they stop. So there's no more a drain on this reserve that you've set off to the side, and they start paying you benefits after the elimination period.
Now, that's a rider that is on most traditionals, or if not, I think you can add it. But the premiums stop. So the premiums stop, and the policy starts paying out. But you still have your reserve money. Whereas in the hybrid, you don't have any premiums because they're one-pay policies. But the first dollars out are your death benefit, which is your return of premium. So you could still die with nothing. Now, the insurance company would say, well, you did get your premiums back. Yes, you did, and it went to long-term care. Under the structure that I just described to you, you go on claim, the premiums stop, you still have your reserve money. Now, you might be spending it on other things, but theoretically, Chris, you still have a reserve that, quote unquote, you can leave if you die, which is what a lot of people are worried about. I think it's needless. The return of premium feature to me, Chris, is the least compelling, the least important feature of these policies.
Right. When you really look at it, I totally agree. But the general public, for the longest time, that was one of the biggest concerns or complaints they raised about buying long-term care.
Exactly. And again, it makes me scratch my head because it means you want to go on claim. That's what you're saying. What if I don't use it? Oh, horror. What if you die peacefully in your sleep and you never spend the last year or two of your life relying on someone to wipe and clean you? Gee, bummer. I don't get it. Right. I was trying or going to try. I've shared openly. I was going to wait until 60, and we explained how we feel that is a ridiculous fallacy, and I fell for it. And it cost me dearly because I suffered a massive stroke last year, and the chances of me getting coverage with my AFib and stroke, slim to none, at least right now. But when I was doing it, Chris, I was going to do it, the least important thing I was looking for was, am I going to get my premium back? And I wasn't buying it in the hopes that I would use it. I was buying it in the fear I might need it. I would love, Chris, if I was eligible for LTC now, to write on my deathbed, say, well, that was a waste of money. Why? It's because at least I lived healthy enough that I didn't need someone to take care of me at the end. So I think the return of premium feature is just overblown, but correct, Chris, playing on the fear. The insurance industry did studies and they found the number one reason people wouldn't buy LTC is they thought the money would go to waste. And the only thing I can think of on that, Chris, it's because none of us want to be that person in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And because of that emotional block, we think, I'm never going to use it. This is not going to happen to me. It's a waste of money. I'm not going to be that person. It's good to think that, but it could happen.
Right.
Okay. He continues. Some of the podcasts also encourage people to buy policies from mutual companies because they say you are owners of the company, not just a customer. What do you think about that? Again, that is often used by mutual insurers as a selling point, and I have nothing against it. Generally speaking, mutual insurers pay higher dividends on life insurance policies than publicly traded companies that are owned by shareholders mm-hmm. as opposed to policyholders. So I agree with a lot of that. But again, I think you are narrowing it down if you only look at one type.
I think it's totally possible that a policy from a publicly traded non-mutual insurance company could be better than one from a mutual company. So if you put a filter on and say, I'm only going to get it from a mutual company, I think you might be arbitrarily eliminating some choices.
Exactly. And then finally, he says, some of those companies say that the credit rating of the insurance companies are not important because they are regulated by the states. And it would be a scandal if a state let the insurance company fail. Hence, the worst case scenario you would have is the state would arrange a takeover of the policies and they will be transferred to another company. To me, this is complete bogus. And I feel nothing would be worse than paying for LTC for years, and when you need it, the insurance company is no longer in business. If someone is saying that, that's horrendous.
Yeah. Insurance, why rate insurance companies right. then? It would be my comment. It's plus, but I do think it's unlikely that insurance companies don't generally completely fail, and you've had a long, you've bought from a reasonably rated company. But the last thing you want is an insurance company that you're trying to get benefits from going through the turmoil of regulators involved and buyouts and all this kind of stuff. So even if there is this protection, I think it is pie in the sky thinking, just so overly optimistic that it's not going to disrupt the claims paying process of the firm that's going through this trauma. Just for that, I would look for a higher rated insurance company.
Right. To say don't worry about ratings. If someone is selling you or trying to push a policy from a low rated company and they're saying the states won't let them fail or they will find a buyer. First of all, insurance companies have failed in the past. It's mm-hmm. it's not common, but they have. Generally, smaller firms, I don't even remember or know if there ever was a time where a huge 100-plus-year-old, highly rated insurance company ever failed. But regional insurance companies, fraternal insurance companies, they have failed. Mm-hmm. And we're not picking on them, but insurance companies have failed. To say they don't is crazy. They can fail. So what you look for is a higher rated company. To say, though, that the state will arrange for another insurance company to come buy your policy? No one is going to pay a failing insurance company money to take on long-term care. Mm-hmm. Hey, gee, I never received any premiums. This is like if I ran an insurance company and you came in and said you got a proposal and I would be sitting there. Well, Chris, let me get this straight. You want me to take $800 million from our reserves, give it to a failing insurance company, and take on all their legacy long-term care insurance policies that we've received no premiums on and start paying on them? Uh-huh. It wouldn't work that way. Now, that's not to say that books of business can't be sold. They can be. Mm-hmm. Would they ever be sold? I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into that, but the business of the state isn't to necessarily go out and arrange buyers. They may approve the sale, and companies sell book of businesses all the time. Especially life insurance and annuity business get sold all the time from one company to another. I don't know how many insurance companies would be wanting to run out and buy an LTC book, Chris, because so many carriers don't sell LTC anymore. There used to be over 100 carriers. Now I think there's about a dozen. They're getting out of it. They don't want to be in it anymore. It's not profitable. It's too expensive and scary and dangerous. And the carriers that remain, I would only choose a highly rated carrier. I'm sorry, I would. I would only go with an A, A+, A++. To me, that's just the way I would look at it. But if someone is saying you got nothing to worry about with a lower rated carrier, I would look long and hard on that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Okay. Well, I think that about wraps it up.
Yep, you got to get to your...
I got to get to my haircut because haircut, I still have thick, dark, luxurious hair, unlike some people.
Not as thick and luxurious as it once was.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But yes, it's...
I got more than you, and that's all that matters.
Thick enough to need cutting.
I wake up every morning, and as I look, I
and
say...
you have to brush your hair.
I got more than Chris. That's all that matters. That's all. Well, I got hair.
It's a low bar.
I got hair.
Perfect.
I may not have a girlfriend and children or even a wife ever, and my dog died, and I had a stroke, but I got
but
hair.
But you got your hair.
And that keeps
Perfect.
Me going.
Good, good. Well, you have fun at your haircut. You can take off. I know you got to go, so all I'll right. shut things down here. So
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening to another Q&A show here on the Retirement and IRA Show. Like I mentioned before, we've got that special guest, Wade Pfau, is going to be on the EDU show. I think it's the show that's going to release on October 6th. I believe we're recording that with him on the 5th. So something to look forward there, forward to there. If you want to send in a question for the Q&A show, best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can submit comments and questions that way, or you can email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.